So these two functions graduate from college. One was exceptional. The other one, sadly, had to become a monad. Hey, hey, howdy ho! That's my best one so far. Daniel Markham here with the Nerd Roundup. It's Friday again, and I can't. You're paying for this. The money back guarantee if you don't like the jokes you're hearing. And if you're paying for this, then let me know because somebody's ripping you off. What's Nerd Roundup? Nerd Roundup is just some friends of mine getting together every Friday talking about what's been going on in the news for the past week. I provide a list of links just as something, kind of a conversation starter, but we're free to do whatever we want. The only rule is there are no rules. Have fun. And this week we have John Kern. John, good to see you, my friend.
That was like a software dad joke. That was actually pretty funny.
Yeah, because you got the exceptions, and then you got the monads, and yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. That's a trooper. Yeah, it's a good dad joke. Right, not a nomad, but a monad. What was it last week? James was like, I don't understand the joke. And I had to explain the joke. I'm like, oh, man. It's not good when you have to explain. That's not a good thing. What you been up to this week, John?
I'm about to do it this afternoon, but was creating some content for helping kind of nudge some product management owner types in an organization that does what I think is too much work up front. So doing some, trying to paint a picture of how to go from fuzzy to precise, and combination of things like, you know, how to break down requirements, how to organize them, domain modeling, story mapping, like Jeff Patton stuff, BDD, you know, how to articulate, you know, instead of just a big splotch of, because right now they'll create tons of acceptance criteria in like this giant prose form. And, you know, you can spot things that are unnecessary, things that are, you know, not focused, random stuff thrown in there, and then missing, you know. So that's kind of what I was working on and going to deliver it this afternoon and with some exercises, yeah, to help. Yeah.
That's the cool thing about Gherkin. In my opinion, if you're doing Gherkin the right way, once you start defining terms, you're kind of forced to use those same definitions again. It helps you clean up the language quite a bit.
Yeah, and that's part of it is, you know, I always try to say use the domain language that the business is using.
Yes.
And the scenario approach and the background approach will give them a little more precision and you know, standardization, so to speak, because sometimes I would hear, oh yeah, well, it was hard to test. We didn't know like how to test. Well, if you did a given, I'm, you know, logged in as such and such a user and such an organization with these kind of settings that are pertinent to the story, you know, all that stuff magically, yes, you know, disappears because you've got some, you know, a little more precision. And hopefully we'll try to get that into some automated tests because the organization also, devs write code, they'll do the unit test, but somebody else does the actual testing and somebody else does the automation. Like, that's not so helpful. That's just, you know, anyway.
It occurred to me while you were talking that you're one of the few people who have done like true round tripping. I've done it by hand using UML. But so many times we teach UML and MDA and all that stuff as being this kind of one-way thing, when really the power of the whole thing is using the model is sort of to create a ubiquitous language that then
works.
And if you do that the right way, it becomes very simple to do the tests and all that.
That word ubiquitous, I used to call it the lingua franca, right? I mean, it does establish a known, this is our world. And when new features come in, does it fit in this world? Or do I have to get a big hammer out? Or do I need to expand the world because this is a new concept? All right.
Or I'm worked with the point, if you get so, your model gets so big, and I used to call between 20 and 30, I'll call it. But if it gets so big, your class model, are we redefining things in subtly different ways that we should go back and sort of refactor our analysis model?
True. I often joke that I grew up modeling, and Peter Code was really my mentor. starting in the early 90s about, you know, learning how to do object modeling. And I would often joke that back then, because I couldn't afford a E-size plotter, models had to fit on a standard letter, at most illegal, right? But so that led to fairly well, decomposed and organized and compartmentalized. And, I like to joke, it almost forced that the model can't be so, I'd love to have a plotter and show 300 classes on a freaking giant diagram.
It's been done. It's lots of fun.
I would walk through a cubicle land and see them proudly, ERDs or object models. I'm like, yeah, what I'm more content with is being able to express things and really break them down into smaller bits that are digestible and focused. And my joke was, I got good at that because of the limitations of my printer.
Yeah, I came at this through ER diagramming and database modeling, and I learned how to normalize databases, and then I got into UML, and I started thinking in terms of, as if I was building a database, which a lot of people did back in the day. But then at some point when I was doing sort of big project kickoff things, it occurred to me, really we're getting more value out of this modeling exercise than the code is. We're able to sort of break up projects, they would decide on whether the same behaviors are happening over and over again. And walking through those classes and going through business test cases, I mean, that was a very, very powerful thing to do with a bunch of people. It didn't really matter whether the code came out the other end or not. So I realized at some point that really the people was the goal, not the code. And that kind of helped me out a little bit. And John went away. Come back, John. He came back.
Yeah. There he is. Sorry about that.
No problem. So let's go on. This week, what I've been doing, I wrote a couple Bash scripts. I talked with Greg Young a bit about doing something we're calling a nerd ninja, where we just take a piece of code that we've written and kick it around some. It's not gelling yet, and the reason it's not gelling is Nerd Roundup is like tech articles, friends, have fun, no rules. With any kind of code review, I'm not really sure what the overall goal is. It's not gelling for me that way yet. I'm still kind of working on it.
Yeah, I mean, code review is a little tougher. There's fun things you can do reviewing cubes in terms of pointing out it's better to show intention than it is to show, specific mechanistic thing, But yeah, code, it's
yeah, you can do a war story thing, or you can do like a review my code thing. And I'm okay with, I try to be ego-free. It's not an ego thing. It's just that what am I trying to really convey here? I'm not going to teach every concept in a big hunk of code. So, what's the fun part, really?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Good question.
Yeah. Yeah, what's so fun about this? So the first article here is, can you build a satellite made out of wood? It turns out some Finnish folks are actually going to do this. I got this picture of like this YouTube channel, build your own wooden satellite in your backyard. And I guess there's no reason you couldn't use wood. It's not something I ever thought about, really.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like there's a lot of force up in space, just saying.
Yeah. Yeah, I think they were doing vacuum tests of various things, and they were using a wooden rig to do the vacuum test, and somebody was like, well, why don't we just make the satellite itself out of wood? And nobody could come up with a reason not to. It's not going to catch on fire. I mean, that's not going to happen.
Yeah. Yeah. It is interesting.
Yeah. I look forward to our wooden, the wooden rocket launch. That might not go so well. I
don't... Yeah. I'm pretty sure that's what.
Yeah, you're going to want to use steel or titanium on the rocket side. Okay, so the next article here is really, really cute. Tamami Emure did a git commands explained using cats. And it's just awesome. I love this. I have to admit, I and I'll have no problems admitting this. I suck at Git. And one of the reasons I suck at it is I don't use it in a interactive, complex team setting very much. I pull, I make changes, I push, a diff every now and then. So I'm keeping this like bookmark to come back to if I run any problems. It's cute. That's just really cute.
Yeah, I certainly have some favorite Git cheat sheets, and never really was on enough of a kick-ass team to be anything other than feature branches and some pull requests, and you know, maybe that mode of working in a team environment. And it's certainly, I had essentially a handful of favorite commands that you use all the time, and you know, I even put some aliases in there, shortcut them, which would then, if you go to somebody else's computer, if you're working with them, and then you try that at home, it doesn't work because they don't have the same alias. So sometimes I would even try to help, you know, establish some similar, you know, like Git CO for checkout, or, you know, just some stupid stuff like that where, you know, you get the commands work everywhere, so to speak. But yeah, that is cool.
Yeah, Git is like, they say Linux, you bring your own screwdriver and bolts, and Git's the same way. You can do this a bazillion different ways. It's enormously powerful, but I haven't been on a team that's done the true peer-to-peer and all that. Okay, so this is probably the most out of my wheelhouse, but I saw this and I had to catch it. This is a PDF. Larger H sub zero values in the C cosmic microwave background dipole direction. Okay, so I tease this apart the best I can, okay, is that we're in the universe, and the universe, there's a big bang, they think, and then there was an inflationary phase, and it's way out there. Like, we're inside a balloon, it's expanding all equally in all directions. And they start to look at, is that really true? Is it really expanding equally in all directions or not?
Right.
And they're thinking, well, if quasars and gamma wave bursts are actually what they call standard candles, the data's showing no, it may actually be more of an ellipsoid. And if that's true, then the math's off somewhere or another. So that's pretty cool stuff. But it would be at the scale of galaxies. It wouldn't be, you know, we don't have anti-grav cars coming anytime soon, but.
Yeah, it is a make your head hurt sort of mind-bending concept about, like, how can there be an edge?
Yeah, and I think one of the things they say is that they can't see the edge yet. They can see the microwave background, but they're not really sure how far up the entire thing goes.
And I can also paradoxically say, why wouldn't there be an edge? Right, so.
Okay, so my favorite model, just you know, if we're sitting back drinking beers, wearing togas or whatever, is that the black holes are actually the edges. And the universe, instead of like being a sphere, is actually more like a piece of Swiss cheese. And that the holes are the edges, yes. That it ends up being this sort of big spaghettified thing where the outside is the inside.
That works, just because it solves that paradox.
Yeah, that makes my head hurt even more. It's cool to say, but I don't think about it too much. If you're interested in this the second link here in the list, this lady does a wonderful job of going down all the reasons why, you know, maybe we're actually on to some new physics here, and it may be another 10 years. And I think this week, I've been reading about this for probably 20 years. This week, I'm starting to feel like, yeah, I think that we're turning the tides on this. It's going to be 10 years from now, maybe, but I think the models are going to be tweaked. It's going to be something new. And that's really cool. Okay, so let's get off the physics, because we're right on that. Let's go back to coding. One of the guys I follow on Twitter, and this made me sad. I get sad when I see tweets. It makes me sad. I'm begging software people to talk to a single traditional engineer.
Oh, yeah.
So this is back to the, is software design really architecture? Is it really engineering? Is it? And he basically is trying to make the point that there should be a standard screw and a standard hammer, and software just isn't at that point yet. And the premise here is sort of the same as the Gang of Four Patterns book, and that is that there's some sort of universal set of abstractions we're trying to look for, and that once we settle on that, we're going to kind of have it done. That's not been my experience so far. I don't think that's going to happen.
Yeah, it is. It is a fascinating concept, because certainly coming from aerospace engineering and stumbling into software and then coming into the software world, I do remember some of those, like, wow, holy cow. Yeah, no, this isn't engineering at all. This is like just a crapshoot.
Yeah.
And I've often felt that one of the biggest conundrums of our industry is, I'll maybe say it a couple of ways. It's, if you could visualize, for example, a bridge or a building that reflected maybe the architecture in some pieces of crap systems that I've seen, I'm pretty sure the human lay person's, anybody's, just a normal person, not engineer, just a person, just a regular person, would not walk across that bridge, would not go in the building. Like, just innately understanding this is not possibly safe or well-designed or well-architected, I don't trust it. And we don't have that same capability. The users, and I can argue both points. Like, I can argue, who cares? Just build another one. Just build it again. Although people don't do that. They just keep piling on top of a bad design, typically, until they go bankrupt or just, suffer from, that just sucks. But, and another analogy is, my father built, immense gardens of, they called square foot gardening, raised beds. Everything was very scientific, shall we say, in terms of, cooperative planting, and you never compact the soil, and he had, three bins of composting, right? An amazingly productive per square foot. And you have some of those community gardens, like at a workplace. I remember when I was working at the Naval Air Propulsion Center, you could have a plot of land out back, they plow it for you, and then sometimes they turn into just weed fests. Both ostensibly produce tomatoes, let's say. And if you have CEOs of those two companies, they can't see the gardens. One has no idea if it's from a beautiful manicured English garden or a weedy thing. And does it matter? Do they know that this one over here produces more with less effort than this one over? And I think that's the conundrum of our nascent industry, is we suck at knowing any of that.
And yeah, I completely agree. And we don't join the gardening back up to the product. So some people are like, hey, it's a perfect garden, I don't care what you're doing with the tomatoes. Some people are like, hey, I get tomatoes, I don't care about the garden. But none of us are actually making spaghetti. Right. So it's the guys who are making spaghetti look at us as if we were some sort of strange service they're using, when in fact, whatever we're doing over there is probably going to play a key part on how good the spaghetti is going to be.
That's an interesting angle. Yeah. The tying back to, does the quality of the approach, like whether it's gardening or architecting buildings, impact the end user? I submit yes.
Yes, absolutely. Not only that, but there's a machine that's trying to get whatever you're doing to the user that should be the coder, really. I know people don't like me saying this, but programming is the new writing. We're like scribes from the year 1000. Back then, if you were rich, you had a scribe who would go write things for you, maybe read things to you. And that was, writing and reading was viewed as sort of a hands-off approach, we don't deal with that. And of course, now you would be ludicrous if you couldn't read or write and do it in a good fashion. I see programming kind of taking that same trajectory.
Interesting. Yeah.
So yeah, I think you were talking about before we started that, I forget, I think we were talking about Gherkin and talking about moving from fuzzy to concrete. And you do that in program. That's the real work, is taking somebody talking to you and turning into some math. And yeah, I think you view it just as math, you're screwed up. If you view it just as language, you're screwed. It's a little bit of each.
Good point.
Next up, this came out, I think, last Friday. U.S. Cybercom says mass exploitation of Atlassian Confluence vulnerability ongoing and expected to accelerate. And they said, you do not have the weekend to fix this. You have to go fix it now, which is a little unusual for Cybercom. Did you hear about this? He's frozen. I will continue to talk as if you're not frozen. There you are. So did you hear about this Confluence vulnerability?
Well, you would think, because I work at Adaptivist, which is one of Atlassian's largest partners, it was probably in the general Slack channel with a big, you know, at everybody. But I missed this because I know our teams are constantly getting these ahead of time, and we work to try to help close any kind of gaps, you know, because we build a lot of products on top of Confluence and Jira. So I'm sure a bunch of my colleagues are really well aware of this.
So
this is pretty crazy.
Yeah, I don't want to bang on Jenkins or Atlassian, but there's this thing I found. Look, digging into this, it's used in multiple products called, what is it? OGNL. And this, first of all, I was Cybercom issuing an alert saying you don't have the weekend, go fix it now, which was kind of wild. I dig down, I find this OGNL thing. And it's like, what is object graph notation language? And basically, it's a way to muck around in your object graph without having to deal with silly things like encapsulation or polymorphism or any of the things. So, I mean, if you're setting a test up or a build, maybe you want to know what's the second child or the third object down, or blah, 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 blah. So you just write a notation language and the compiler goes out and gets that. Well, golly gee, if you're going to kind of reach around all that OO stuff to muck around down here where you want to do, you're going to have some problems later. That's going to hurt a bit. It's not going to be fun.
And it's almost like dot notation, like in, you know, Mongo or something like that, where you can try to, you know, keep going after child elements, child properties.
But it's and I may have this wrong. If I have it wrong, I apologize because I scanned it. But I can see why you would want to do this if you're setting up a CI/CD testing platform, because people don't design software to be tested. So you need some way of getting at the thing you can't get to. But the problem is that we're telling people to design software to be tested, and we're telling people if you stick something inside a private method or whatever, people can't get to it. And then if you break that rule, what the hell are we telling this other stuff for?
Yeah. Interesting.
So fun times. It gives an example. It gives an example of a user-provided OGNL expression. This sounds much like an SQL injection problem, except for using OGNL. So we invented a new query notation language. Somebody didn't escape it out the right way, then users can send in crap and take over your server. doesn't make for a fun weekend for a lot of guys, I guess.
Yeah. Did I do that?
Oh, my God. Yeah. Yeah, I have worked at places where you wish they gave you, like, a fire helmet because it's just, what is it now? Oh, my God. And every day it was like, oh, my God, there's this fire and this thing. And,
yeah, that's pretty crazy.
And eventually,
yeah, and that's, you may, I don't know if that sort of stems back to the whole engineering thing, and the whole mysteriousness and the lack of, like, if you could put it in vision, this would be a great idea. Like, if we could somehow put some of these things in visual analogs, so you could walk around and see it. Oh,
yes.
Who left the gate open? Who left the gate open to our, you know, gold lockbox? Like, what the heck? But we can't see a lot of things. And there's you know, most the compartmentalization. Yeah, it's actually a really fascinating challenge. And I keep calling it a conundrum.
That's a cool word. Who can pass up on a conundrum? Yeah, you should use it.
Right.
I like problematic is good. It's a problematic conundrum is what it is.
There you go. Yeah.
You know, I subscribe to the Atlassian. They're doing a DevOps pipeline podcast they started. Yeah, I think you turned me on to that. And they were talking about sort of enterprise errors and how to deal with feedback loops and all that. And it occurred to me that not only is what you're saying true, but we don't like admitting that we can't see that there's a hole in the fence or whatever. It's everybody wants to pretend as if they understand the stack all the way down. Anybody who's really coded knows, hell, I can write three lines of code and not know what the hell's going on.
I feel blessed in so much of my journey, where as a young engineer working in no less Fortran 2, flight simulation for F-14 spins, and then a centrifuge, and really, really awesome, that I basically was rewriting the core algorithms that had relied on some 60-bit twiddling, some really like opaque, like, okay, I'm an aero engineer learning software, and I would have to ask some software experts, the hell is this thing doing? Oh, that's like, some bit manipulation in a crazy ass. The cyber was 60-bit, which is like, wait, did you say you're mistaken? I'm sure.
58.5 bits. Yeah, it's like, what the hell?
Yeah. Who does 60? Not 64?
Yeah. What do you do with the other 4 bits? Well, we probably don't. Yeah. Dong. It's a thing. But yeah. We collect them for a half hour. We give them off to another computer.
And so, I had some print statements in there, just making sure things were right. And everything was cool. Everything was working. The actual simulation was working. I took, disabled the print statements, and then things weren't right. But, finally narrowed it down through, of course, not any, great thing other than manual labor, to this print statement. And what it turned out, I painstakingly documented it. Look, with this in, it works. With it out, it doesn't work. And it turned into the Fortran compiler optimization.
Yeah, you told us that this is the compiler error, right?
Yeah, and that was the light bulb moment that, oh yeah, people are writing this stuff too. Up until that point, I felt, of course, that stuff is perfect. Why, why would it be that? It must be me, right? And that was a real educational moment. Then, to your point, that people are writing the underlying server codes, and people they're still humans writing code. And even though you might think, all right, it's a little better because more eyeballs are on it, the likelihood of finding holes is higher. That's true, but still, that was my almost like bursting my little naive bubble of the world isn't as perfect as you think.
Yeah, I struggled. I'm pretty hard-headed, so I struggled for a long time. I struggled with the testing part. I struggled with TDD. And to be honest, the Bobster, I guess 20 years ago, when he first started harping on TDD, was an asshole. I mean that in a nice way, of course. But he tended to be dogmatic, as Bob is wont to do. And that just made me want to go, screw you, pretty much. And so I had to do this, my own journey, like I do everything else, and go around the tree and the bush and the barn and all this other crap. And I finally realized, this deals with mutability, two accounting systems checking against one another. Okay, it started making some sense, and I realized where the edge cases were. Academic programming, business exploration, there are places where you don't know you have value. And quite frankly, if the tomato grows in the backyard, you really need to know if you're selling spaghetti sauce before you go doing any kind of garden. And even though that was a common story of the proof of concept that gets scaled out, that's not just a failure story. If you're the proof of concept that a million people are coming by, that's actually the rare story. What I heard from my startup friends was everybody was over-engineering crap that didn't sell. So I was like, okay, I can see the edge cases now. I can see why a corporate program would always use CDD. I can see why and SQL and pure functional languages, you probably wouldn't. I had a hard time coming around to this.
Yeah, over-engineering is, I try to use phrases, I try to help people. Last week there was a couple of beautiful examples right before our very eyes where despite a lot of upfront work to prepare this story, I actually plucked. We were going to do a little. This was a prior group that we were going to do a little story writing exercise, a little BDD, a little Gherkin, around something on their stack. Let's work with your example. I'm not going to make one up. I picked something that looked cool. Like, I bet we can find a few scenarios in there. And we started working on, I gave it a simple exercise. Just first off, try to define what's the title of the feature. What's the basic feature here? And long story short, it turned out, wow, I'm glad we talked about this. We accidentally discovered, that would have been implemented if we hadn't stumbled on it. They all agree. This would have just gone to production as is. But we discovered after trying to think about it a little more, stand back, that, wait, what's the root cause of why we're doing this? Oh, well, instead of popping up an error message saying, you can't do that now, which those always drive me crazy, right? Because it's like, well, dumbass, you wrote the damn system.
Sorry, this feature is not implemented. It's like, I clicked on a damn button. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you can't use this feature yet. All right, well, then why'd you let me try? Just to tell me I'm stupid, right? So anyway, it was one of those moments where we realized, despite all of the acceptance criteria, all of the laborious work, all of the down to the footer of the warning message, maybe we actually need to rethink the onboarding process. So I tried to help the team there understand that this is an opportunity to think about. Luckily, we avoided implementing it because we've come up with, hey, we think we have a better idea. But think about, how can you more rapidly get to this discussion? You know, there was a lot of work up front, thought everything was perfect. How can we more quickly get to actually doing the thing? And there was another example with another group where we were actually looking at the things they were doing, and there were some problems with the dropdown and the I understand button that was, anyway, another logical conundrum that luckily there was a business person in the room, and she was almost apologetic and humbled that she was invited. I'm like, no, man. She even said 2 cents. I'm like, no, this is amazing. You're the first business, right? Because that's another problem. The business people aren't in the room.
Yep.
I said, no, this is $1.98. This isn't 2 cents. And your instinct is right. And then we talked about it. Again, it was an opportunity. They had all the, mock-ups, all the work up front. And boom, we don't want this.
Uh-huh.
And the discussion was, how can you more quickly get to the discussion about doing the real thing and finding the real answers, not thinking of.
Yeah. And you hung for a second. Yeah, I completely agree, John. I think sometimes these projects will get a momentum of their, And so you'll have a BA or an analyst that puts a feature in a PowerPoint somewhere, and then they feel sort of married. And it takes a little bit of coaxing and encouraging. No, if you really don't need it, we can just stop now. It'd be better. And it's tough. It's a tough call for some folks.
Yeah, and that's what I'm trying to get them to think about is, can I get away with less? And, be lazy, I like to joke. Because if you don't, and also have a collaborative discussion instead of, I'm going to think of it all on my own and throw it over the wall. No, why don't we meet together? I want the business and the QA and the dev, maybe UX, depending on what we need to talk about, in a room, having that conversation ahead of time. It's how do I take the risks and understand what they are at that fuzzy point and say, oh, there really aren't any, I don't think so. Just leave it as a paragraph for now. We can fill it out later. Or, wow, that's a really great idea, but I see some problems that, we might need to think. And it's that risk mitigation and doing it just at the last responsible moment. That's hard for a lot of people.
I teach this. I've been doing this. Yagni, I've been doing TED tests for a long time, 10 years or so. And two things just really amaze me about programming. And the first is how quickly I lose the plot over what I'm doing. And I don't realize I'm doing that. It's just I'm very confident and things are, I'm in the flow. But really, it's just kind of working now. It's not really, TDD points that out immediately. And the second thing is, I can take a hammer and beat on my head and say, Yagni, 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 over and over again. And I will still, every damn time, start building some kind of crap I really don't need. It's amazing that people kind of gravitate toward adding stuff on.
Yeah, I often will kick myself and say, I wish I would be a consultant for myself sometimes while I'm writing code for, you know, the fire planning app. Because, yeah, it's the same thing. You find yourself, oh, crap, I just went down a rat hole. That if I were consulting somebody or pairing with them, I would have prevented. But I can't often prevent it in myself.
I was building this up. I have this thing called an analysis compiler. Basically, you take freeform notes, and it turns it into Gherkin feature files and all kinds of other stuff. The idea is if you capture a concept like customer during your note-taking, you can keep track of conversations around customer throughout the whole life cycle of the product.
Yep.
But I started writing this compiler, and I said, well, I've got to have logging or I can't debug the compiler. So I added this really cool logging library. We'll scale out to like a million different clients in the cloud. It's just, it's amazing. It's async, and you just throw things over, and you can pipe stuff into the... And the same thing for error handling. I couldn't do just error handling. I had to do this pure functional. It was amazing. And then I want to be able to throw a file at the exe file and have it work as if it were GCC to compile the file. Well, hell, if you're using .NET, .NET streams and Windows streams don't work the same way as Unix streams do, because Windows doesn't send an in the stream or whatever, so you hang. So then I had to write a threading app that like set up a monitor to monitor the stream coming in if nothing happened in 5 seconds. And so I've got like, I don't know, like 5,000 lines of crap I probably never needed, but it's awesome. It's really cool, though.
Yeah, yeah, and that's where a lot of times I'll try to help folks look for, you know, whether it's a brand new product or, you know, adding something, a major feature. It's, you know, is there one thing that has to be
right
and focus on that? Yes. Because if I can't get, you know, whatever you were trying to do with the EXEs or, you know, but a lot of times I stumble onto groups that are doing the easy stuff and they have not actually focused on, wait, if this one piece doesn't work, you mean the rest is worthless? Yes. Well, then why the hell aren't you doing that?
Yes. You know, and you should, instead of, I think what we do is instead of trying to find the most hardest string and pull from end to end, we try to like throw stuff at the problem, hoping if we build up a big enough snowball that somehow it will cover that string that we're going to do last, probably. It's like, no, you're doing exactly the opposite way you should be doing this.
Yeah, yeah. And it's a little bit like the analogy of our son does machining of, you know, medical equipment stuff. And the same kind of thing there. Don't save the hardest operation and the riskiest operation to be your last one. Because you just built all that value of all the other operations you did on the part. And if you fail it at the very end, that's the biggest, worst thing you could do.
And not only that, I'm beginning to think, you know, you guys can kick me out of the nerd club if you want to, but I'm beginning to think that make the damn thing work at the command line. Do the tough business problem first, and then the UI and deployment, all that's debatable. You can work and figure it out. You know, if you could come up with a command line program that solves world hunger, it's good. It doesn't have to be an iOS app. It's fine. You did a good job. But instead, we add in all this other stuff. It's like, unless you're building just an entertainment thing, like a game, you should accrete the cool part, not just start with the cool part.
Yeah, that gets down to one of my three rules of, you know, how to build successful software products. And it starts with the business, the problem domain, right? That's the most important part. Nothing else matters. You know, I can do persistence, I can do UI, and that even changes, you know, with the whims of what's great and cool. But the business is, I often say, probably the slowest moving target. And if it's not, well, then you need to understand that and base your solution around a fast moving business model.
Yes.
Okay, well, that's also the business. The point is, you know, that's kind of what you're getting at. Like, if you get it right, the rest is simple. I mean, you might have fancy schmancy UIs, but anybody can do that. If you don't get the business right, none of that other stuff matters. You can have the world's best database model. You can have the world's best UI. But if you miss the business, who cares?
And when we're talking about, you know, I keep making the same two mistakes. I find that when I make the Yagni mistake, it's almost always because it speaks to some sort of inner coolness to me. It's like something I wanted to do always, or this is the other guys were talking about it. And that just leads me astray almost every time. So next up, IEEE Spectrum did the top programming languages. The top five were Python, Java, C, C++, and JavaScript. Python? Python. I wouldn't suspect that it would have been Python. That's the one of the top five I've never coded much in. Would you have suspected Python would have been on the top five?
Only that I know in goofy ways. Like, I've only brushed up against it for doing something like a multi-mechanized, a way to do performance testing against like a web app. Basically, you can machine gun, you know, HTTP commands, and you can simulate stuff. And that was some Python script. And then I've seen other things that I've stumbled on for maybe graphing things that are Python. So I wonder if it's because a bunch of little tiny things are built in that a bunch of just regular folks can grasp onto and play with. I don't know, but I've never written anything major. I've just diddled with tiny little Python scripts to do really discrete things.
Yeah, same here. My Python experience consists of writing AWS Lambda functions where you'd get an environment set up and they'd throw in a zip file what your inputs are, and you don't know where the machine is or whatever, but you have Python. And so you get stuff coming in, you Python it for a function, you know, maybe 20, 30 lines of code, and then you throw stuff in a zip, send it back out. It was nowhere near like writing, it was just glue app, I guess what you call it, not writing a full-fledged app.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was kind of wild that Python was, I can see Java being at the top and C and C#, but I guess just because it's universally on a Unix machine.
Oh, yeah, probably.
So this, like, I took note of, I don't want to do this kind of rant thing, but it just, I ran across this interesting phrase. Amazon considers more proactive approach to determining what belongs on its cloud service. As I understand the backstory, in the States, we had some issues on January 6th with the guy wearing, it was the whole thing, and people were hurt, killed. It was an awful thing. Trespassing, the horns were, it was ugly. It was bad. And they should go to jail. I have no problem, you know, take them out and hang them. I don't care. But what I do care about is because they used Amazon tech, Amazon is now saying, you know, hey, we're going to start scanning our stack a little better, make sure we ain't got no more folks doing stuff they shouldn't be doing using our tech. And I'm like, where does that stop?
It doesn't.
Yeah. And the phrase I heard was censorship creep, like scope creep. It's like once you start down this road, there's no real logical place to stop.
Yeah, they should have stopped subprime mortgages.
Yeah. Yeah, so, hey, James, welcome back.
Hey, how goes it?
It goes well. We've gotten through the physics part of stuff, and now we're just getting to the sort of back-in-my-day ranting stuff.
All right. I missed the physics, darn it.
One of our common Twitter friends texted me something about, I said, you might not be here this week, and he said, oh, I miss James. He said, I watch every week, and I said, you know, it must be nice to have that much time on your hand to watch every week. So I think we have our first inside joke, is James always saying it must be nice to have that much time.
Good line.
All right, you will say, yep. And then, now you know it's not a non-disrespectful thing.
Right. Right. We're just going to treat it as an affectation.
Yeah, like, absolutely.
So this next one, this is what I call an X-File story. And the reason I call it X-File stories is because it tells me something I want to believe, but I'm not really sure I can believe or not. And what it's telling me is that they're building a new Skunkworks plant to build super secret, probably UAVs. And Lockheed Martin says they're going to make the entire plant completely reconfigurable and robotic. And I'm like, seriously? Really? That's wild. You can really do up. I thought, are we already doing this? I mean, you guys know anything about how deployed we are as far as fully automated robotics on factory floors?
Yeah. If you watch, for example, which truck plant was it? I forget if it was Daimler Benz. But a complete, like a sea of robots doing the actual soup to nuts of the entire tractor of a tractor trailer, you know, including the cab, and they weren't even welding. They actually had these new techniques of these kind of boom, 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 almost, I won't say rivets, but they almost look like, you know, so they even, And the full thing, you're just standing there watching all these, you know, picks up the whole thing and takes it down to the next, and fully automated. And that's what will happen when it financially makes sense to fix it in process, and you don't have to pay healthcare. You know, you just have maintenance.
Well, the quality goes up like crazy with the automation.
Who's that, Audi?
Quality.
Oh, quality. Yeah, you can fix it with, yeah, it's the classic. I mean, I always say that in software, fix it, you know, I'd rather fix it in process than try to, you know, just keep training humans to do it better.
So,
yeah, I don't know. It's interesting. It's funny. Like, is this a paradox? Can a Skunk Works be announced? Is it still a Skunk Works?
Yeah, and I bet you they're not using actual skunks either. So it's it's all lies. All lies.
How'd they get away with that?
I don't know.
Yeah, they're appropriating a skunk.
Fake news.
Yeah, that's right. Yes. Yeah, if there were a skunk association, that would be there. It'd be big trouble for that. And I wonder why they called it Skunk Works. And that's an interesting phrase.
I guess in the basement and down in the.
But what does that have to do with a skunk? I mean, I don't.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't have a skunk. I don't want a skunk in my basement.
Maybe it stinks if they hit it.
I don't know. Maybe they had a lot of like Taco Tuesdays there or something. I don't know. This next one is one of the current space station astronauts took a picture edge on of the Earth, and it is just freaking really cool. That's amazing. You can see the sunset, sunrise, the Terminator line in the upper atmosphere, and you can also see the land mass underneath. And I found that a completely amazing picture. I really love those Terminator edge on shots.
Well, where did that picture come from?
The space station. The guy was up in the cupola.
All right, so it's a NASA photo?
This astronaut has his own Flickr feed, and I've got the link in there. You can go see it.
You're going to need that picture. Yeah. But, you know, they've been up there for 20 years. Is this the first time they've done an edge-on picture of the Terminator?
They've done movies. They've done all sorts of stuff, but I think this is the first one I have seen that's got the upper atmosphere glow working just the way he's got it right to Terminator. I've seen him with the blue, but I haven't seen it with the orange and red, which is really cool.
What massive city is that?
I guess it would be a city. Maybe Australia? We got some white there.
Australia is mostly dark, I'd expect.
Yeah, except around the edges. Right? Yeah, it's a lot of nothing. By the way, just a quick ADD moment. The Skunk Works, a name inspired by a mysterious locale from the comic strip Lil Abner, which is a great.
I'll be damned.
Right?
Why wouldn't it be?
1943.
Yeah, Google knows all, tells all. All hail Google. Yeah, wow.
This is from LockheedMartin.com, so yeah.
Okay, wow.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. They were asked to from the Pentagon to have the first prototype in 150 days. They turned one out in 143 days, creating the P-80 Shooting Star.
Oh, damn.
How about that?
I'm just
143 days.
Really happy we're not building artificially intelligent to combat skunks, because that'd be bad. That would be bad for the skunks and us. And yeah.
Yeah.
This next one's another Twitter thread. This is prepare to be sad. What this guy did was he took the grades of students coming out and matched it up out of high school and matched it up with their college degree. So, for instance, if you took everybody with, a B average, 90% of those folks would be able to get a communication or journalism major. But only about 39% would be able to get an engineering major. And so he's showing this big filtering sort process that happens between sort of the same level people coming out of high school and whatever degree they're choosing. And then, of course, you could sort of match that up if you wanted to salaries at the other end. It'd become even more sad.
That's fascinating. Yeah.
Yeah, so I'll have to take a peek at that. When I was in Germany, I was talking to one of my friends here about how they pick people's tracks, like when they're really young.
Yeah.
Like my son's a PhD chemist. He was definitely a late bloomer. In Germany, he'd probably be, you know, painting or plumbing. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but he wouldn't have gotten picked for that track. And here he is. He's like kind of at the top of his field. And I failed science in fourth grade. I definitely wouldn't have been on the engineering track. Right, you know, so
Didn't know they had science in fourth grade.
Well, you know, it's...
Just kidding.
Yeah. So you would have failed it too, huh?
Yeah, maybe you failed it. Yeah, I failed every class my senior year. Every class.
Well, yeah, you're supposed to, right?
Yeah. I did. I had to go to summer school to graduate. It was lots of fun.
Huh. I had kind of a funny thing happen as a sophomore in high school. My teacher in geometry at the end of the semester, whatever it was called, said, "You're actually good at math." It's like, what? I am?
So my chemistry,
you should take some more. It's like, oh, okay.
So my chemistry teacher, he says, "Daniel," he said, "I've been teaching for 25 years. You're the best student I've ever had. I'm going to fail you for the second year in a row." I just did not do homework. I knew the subject. I'm not going to do it. Sorry, I have other things to do. I'm not playing your game, guys. I didn't.
Yeah. Yeah, there you
go.
Well,
this was a really sad fact when I found out probably either partway through or after I graduated with my aerospace degree. My father, smartest man I ever knew, he said he never studied for the tests. He never did, you know, he just listened and didn't take notes. He graduated like summa cum laude and all, you know, got a PhD and all that crap. But I was like, what? Yeah, well, if you're taking notes, you're not listening. You know, you just need to, you know, there's just like, need to listen. But it was like mind boggling to think, like, it's a scary thought. I'm not going to take notes and I'm just going to listen. But I won't have any notes to look at later.
Yeah, but if you get it, you don't need the notes.
Yeah.
So when I got out of the Marines, I went back to college and did, started on calculus and all those things. And I took notes and tried to do it the right way. And I had a 4.0 average, but I found it was harder that way. It's something about it. Then I had to reread my notes and figure out, if you get it in the room with that person, you got it. You're there. You don't have to come back to it.
Yeah, it is kind of fascinating. Is that, you know, different ways of learning, and, you know, that probably applies to our current ways of working and software and everything.
You know, we did this earlier thing with learning Git by using cats. And I had a ninth grade algebra teacher who taught algebra using stories about imaginary animals. And it was the silliest, you know, it's like the cat thing. It was just silly, stupid, you know, as a 15-year-old, I didn't like it and blah, blah, blah. She was probably one of the best teachers I ever had because she took you out of what you thought school was, and you're listening to this story about animals and blah, 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 and suddenly you're knowing, you know how to factor polynomials. And it's like, oh, wow.
And so, you've got this cat image or whatever, this animal image as part of your association you can go put that away with or something, right?
Yeah, it's the memory thing where you memorize things by finding things you already know and then associate with those things.
It's funny how recall works. You know, it's like you got to go start saying a bunch of words to actually unlock that part of your brain where that thing is hidden.
Hey, did you ever take one of those memory courses where you're supposed to learn how to do quick memorization and all that?
No.
Kevin Trudeau, I took the course. And what you do is you have this standard room you use, and here's a curtain, and you know where these things, maybe it's a room you grew up in. And then you just keep that room, and then whatever you're learning, you just associate with parts of that room. And it turns out it's easier to like tag things onto other things than it is to memorize them separately.
Yeah, the Silence of the Lambs and that whole series, I read one of the novels on the topic, and that criminal, when he's about to get caught, he had one of those minds, and they're talking about how he remembered stuff and how he could actually compartmentalize and make pain not matter to him, because he could go to a place where there was no pain. And so, you know, this psychopath guy had these, I don't know if that's based on the memory thing, seemed like, that could work, but it's like kind of weird.
I've heard that as well from like some of these Indian gurus that can slow their breathing down and their pulse rate and some amazing stuff. Sad news.
I want to take one of those memory courses, but then, Daniel, I forgot.
What were we talking about? Yeah, okay, yeah, the memory cord, yeah, okay. Hey, the reason I have this link list is because I couldn't remember enough about what I read in the last week to talk about more than about a minute. Like, yeah, it was something text had some stuff to do with it. So Edinburgh's computer scientists have banned Alice and Bob from being used because Alice and Bob are too Western. If you haven't studied cryptography since 1978, we've been using the names Alice and Bob as two imaginary people that we talk about when we talk about cryptography, but not anymore, buddy.
Sounds like a good move, and it has nothing to do with anything other than, wait, how long are we using this?
78, so 43 years, I guess.
Way to keep improving your course.
Use whatever you want. Heck if I care. But what you're going to do here is all of these guys who learned Alice and Bob stories, to our earlier point, now they're not going to be able to tell, okay, well, you know how you're doing this protocol here. You know, Alice is talking and Bob, no, we don't use that. And suddenly we're talking about nomenclature instead of what the damn protocol is. And it's like, I got the idea. You want to change names, I'm cool with that. But if you're hindering learning, maybe you're not, you know, adhering to your core mission.
I can't, this is not a politically correct thing, of course, to abuse Alice and Bob. Yeah. How could we have gotten away with it so long?
it's just a kid.
I actually know people named Alice and Bob, too, and that would just have screwed it up for me. It's like,
oh, boy. You knew a real Alice and Bob. Oh, my God. Yeah. Were they nice people? Did they share secrets?
When you're working in English, I went to China about 15 times, and all the Chinese people had English names, had Western names.
Oh, wow.
Right? Because you couldn't, and actually they learned that as part of English class, they got to pick a name. And as I understood it, it's like, well, you know, because our names are almost impossible to say in Chinese. They didn't say that, but every time I tried to say their name, they would all laugh. Because I would butcher it so much. I couldn't, if I tried to say hello to them.
No, you can't.
You know, they would laugh at me. It's like, no, yeah. It's like this.
Yeah, you cannot learn a total Nihal. Language no, as Nihal. An adult. Yeah, no. You can't. No.
And they just, you know, back and forth. But they wanted to adapt to the language, you know, so they wanted to be part of the language. And, you know, so are we going to be working in English still? Maybe Alice and Bob are a good choice from that perspective. I don't know. I don't want to sound too Western.
I've had to come to peace with this. I'm not going to do the politics. If you guys feel like you're being whatever, I respect your opinion to want to change things. My problem is I have no sense of style or class at all. So if something is ugly or offensive, and you tell me, I believe you because I'm not going to get in a moral argument about whether Alice and Bob are appropriate or good names. I'm more concerned about the pedagogy part, the teaching part, and how do you go about sharing your knowledge with folks.
Yeah.
And that's that part of it bothers me. I also get the feeling that every sort of generation or so, people have to sort of go nibbling around the edges of whatever field they're in because, well, frankly, there's no advances in some of those fields, and they want to feel like they're doing something useful. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, the unfortunate part is that, you know, it appears that the motivation behind this is they're looking back historically about, you know, finding controversial elements in the university's past. Well, if you judge the past by today, good luck.
Yeah, and to the point, I get the feeling that if somebody like myself were to come out and say, well, what's wrong with Alice and Bob? It would just be playing into this whole sort of internal narrative they have about, well, we're changing things for the better, dang it. And see that guy who's angry? He's wrong. And so
and unfortunately, for the better can only be known in hindsight.
Yeah.
That's egotistical to think you're doing the right thing. You're just trying something new. You don't know if it's right. It makes you feel good. And you might think it makes others feel good. You still don't know if that's good or bad or better, and you won't for maybe another 40 years.
Well, see, that's kind of where, I said I have no sense of style or taste because I am not going to have any more argument with somebody over the internet or in person. I mean, just, I'm not going to do it. If you feel like you're being immoral, stop. If you feel like I'm being immoral, you can tell me. I will try to correct myself. But we are not going to publicly, because frankly, my morals are my own, and I may do a lot of things you may find immoral, and I'm perfectly happy with that.
Yeah.
If it's a matter of style and taste, then I'm a moron. You guys do what you want to do.
No, I'm still trying to figure out. I'd love to know how they actually, like, I love how they say it's a common in computer security literature. Yeah, that's new to me. But
I did the big red book where I started learning my first crypto. It's got Alice and Bob and Eve is the eavesdropper. It's the man in the middle attack you may have heard.
Who do they call the guy in the middle?
Yeah, it's the pathway intruder. They've got a new name for it's not man in the middle anymore because it's
person in the middle,
person
entity in the middle.
Yeah, I don't know, but
hey, I got to find out about these swearing ducks though, because I got to leave in a second.
Okay, right? this is the last one. I had to save this to the last. I don't even know what to do about this. This is
what the duck did they say?
scientists. Who obviously have nothing else to do, and Australia have taught Australian musk ducks to curse. Because who the hell wouldn't want a bunch of ducks cursing at them? I know that's the first thing I'm looking for.
Well, you know what rhymes with duck.
Yeah. You quack at your mama with that bill, kid, huh?
Have you been saving that story, that joke up, Daniel? God. Gosh.
This is the ultimate. This is the best nerd roundup story ever. And so there's an audio file. There are two links on the site. I linked to the PDF, but there is an audio of the duck cursing. And I know if you're like me, you got to hear the duck curse. It's just not the same without that. I think he says, you're bloody fool. Let's see if I can find it. You got it?
Well, the duck isn't cursing. It's just we just have the person trying to get the duck to curse.
It does sound like
something at it.
Oh, I'm going to find. Okay. Here we go. I have the ducks here. We're gonna. Yeah. That's it. You got it. You're playing it.
That's funny.
And I guess the point of this would be that not language, English language is not restricted to birds, I guess, or just parrots. The ducks are birds too, maybe?
Okay.
I don't know the point of this, but there's a huge paper on it. Oh, yeah, the discussion. Yeah. This is, I mean, you're not going to spend, I mean, I know these people, they're not going to waste a whole ton of money teaching ducks to curse, unless there's some serious underlying reason for this.
And actually, they didn't do that great of a job because they only have it saying, you bloody fool.
Over and over, yeah.
Yeah, so it's only swearing if you happen to be in the UK somewhere.
Yeah, that's an Australian duck. You don't want to know.
Oh, okay.
You get a Samuel Jackson duck, you know what he's going to say. Yeah,
all right.
Okay, guys, this is it. Anything you guys have been reading or watching over the last week you'd like to share?
Just, no, nothing.
My wife and
I... Oh, yeah, I was trying to figure out... What was I trying to figure out? Nginx.
Oh, cool, yes.
Just a little bit of Nginx.
Oh. Like Apache, only better.
Yeah. Oh, okay, well...
My wife and I
figured out a couple things, so that's good.
Yeah, let me ping me off on Happy Hill. My wife and I binged this TV show called Fringe about 10 years ago. I don't know if you guys have seen it or not.
Nope. The name sounds familiar. Fringe, yeah.
I was quite impressed. The first half dozen or so shows, I'm like, this sucks. And by the end of season one, I'm like, this is cool. And then they only did 4 or 5 seasons, and it is one story. You learn things in the first few shows, you see in the last. So it's like, which is very rare to see some of these shows.
I make a note of that.
Yeah, good stuff. So let me do the goodbye thing. Hang on a second here. Okie dokie. You have wasted yet another hour Nerd Roundup with James Grinning, John Kern, Daniel Markham. We're happy to have you. Come back. We'll see you on the internet.